two, please.
Court is ready to hear argument in 10-0548, Rusk State Hospital versus Dennis Black.
Mr. Murphy will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. In declining to address the jurisdictional issue in this case, the Court of Appeals erred in two ways. First, it misinterpreted Section 51.014 as a restriction on its consideration of subject matter jurisdiction. Second, it disregarded the fundamental principle that subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time, including for the first time on interlocutory appeal, as this court held in Gibson, because without subject matter jurisdiction, the court is powerless to act. For these reasons, the court should reverse the Court of Appeals' judgment with respect to the jurisdictional issue and dismiss plaintiff's remaining tort claims. To begin, the Court of Appeals' decision departs from the text and purpose of Section 51.014. Section 51.014 expands appellate jurisdiction over certain interlocutory orders. Nothing in the text restricts the court's consideration of subject matter jurisdiction, which is an inherent duty of the court. Also, the Court of Appeals' decision undermines the purpose of Section 51.014, which is judicial efficiency. Requiring remand of jurisdictionally barred claims only adds needless expense and delay to the disposition of jurisdictionally barred claims.
Is there any indication in the record why the hospital did not raise immunity in the trial court?
There's not.
And you talked about judicial efficiency. Wouldn't that have been the better thing to do?
It is. And there is a strong incentive for parties to raise jurisdictional issues as early as possible. But sometimes they escape the attention of the court and parties and are only discovered on interlocutory appeal. So the purpose of Section 51.014 is advanced by the resolution of these jurisdictional issues that are clearly barred by sovereign immunity.
If we decided that some of these jurisdictional issues had to be raised at the trial court, I bet counsel would pay more attention to raising them at the trial court, wouldn't they?
Yes, but that
if you could waive this.
Yes, but subject matter jurisdiction is not waivable, as the court has held over and over as a fundamental duty of the court to determine its jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction cannot be acquired by waiver.
But does sovereign immunity have to necessarily be considered subject matter jurisdiction for this purposes? When we've looked at it before, haven't we looked at it in other contexts?
Yes, well, the concept of subject matter jurisdiction recognizes that sovereign immunity bars a trial court subject matter jurisdiction. So if sovereign immunity is established, as clearly the case here, the trial court has no jurisdiction over those claims.
But isn't that only if we say that sovereign immunity is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction for this purpose?
For what purpose are you speaking of?
For purposes of not being waivable. I mean, subject matter jurisdiction is something that you either have it or you don't, right? And we've talked about in our cases that, with regard to subject matter or with regard to sovereign immunity, that's something that the courts interpret because it's a common law doctrine, right? So we
Correct.
Haven't really held that specific issue, and why would we have to?
Well, sovereign immunity is not waivable because it's a fundamental doctrine that that courts will not be subject to lawsuits against itself in its own courts unless there's a statutory waiver. In this case, there is no statutory waiver.
You're not answering my question. I'm asking, why do we have to consider sovereign immunity to be subject matter jurisdiction with regard to this issue of whether it's waivable?
There's no statute or constitutional provision that requires that, is it?
That requires
that immunity be able to be raised at any point in time, even on appeal for the first time. I mean, that's a doctrine that we've kind of generically stated and held. We haven't, I don't recall, ever dealt into it in detail. I mean, there's a difference, isn't there, between us as a matter of the common law saying this is this is the case about a jurisdictional matter or when it can be raised, versus something like bankruptcy. If it's filed in a state court, an actual bankruptcy, there's an attempt to file it in a bank. You just can't do that under the federal statutes. On the other hand, what Justice Learman, I think, is talking about is something that we've talked about as a matter of common law, and I haven't really dealt into whether there are certain areas of it that make more sense and certain areas that don't.
Well, I'll try to answer your question, Justice Learman. I'm sorry for I don't mean to evade it. Sovereign immunity is not waivable because it is fundamentally...
Why? That's what I'm asking. Why?
Because as a fundamental concept that deprives courts of subject matter jurisdiction. It's a jurisdictional issue, and jurisdictional issues are not waivable.
But what I'm saying is that what you're saying is circular, it seems to me. You're saying that sovereign immunity is not waivable because it's subject matter immunity. Well, I mean, subject matter jurisdiction. That's a common law doctrine. That's because we've said it is. But why do we have to say it is? We've said it is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction for other purposes, but not for this purpose. And the problem is there's so many ramifications with saying that sovereign immunity can be brought up at any time. It's a matter of efficiency. They could be brought up 10 years, 20 years later because it could be a void judgment. So there's a lot of baggage associated with us saying that sovereign immunity is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction for this purpose. And we haven't said that before, so why do we have to say that now?
Well, I mean, the court has considered subject matter, sovereign immunity for the first time on appeal.
But that's because this issue really hasn't been raised. We haven't held on this issue.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Can I ask you a question about the Austin Court of Appeal, the decision?
Louder?
And, do they seem to draw a distinction between the vehicle used to challenge summary judgment versus plea to the jurisdiction in their analysis of these cases and whether or not we can consider the issue for the first time?
The vehicle 5101 for summary judgment?
Yeah, whether you file a summary judgment or plea to the jurisdiction, they seem to have indicated that in some contexts you can raise it on appeal first.
Well, I think that the court's going to look at the substance of the claim. So if it is raised, I think this came up in the Thomas versus Long case where it wasn't technically a plea to the jurisdiction, but the court concluded that it was reviewable on interlocutory appeal because the substance was essentially a plea to the jurisdiction. The Lowry case, which is the case that the court below relied on exclusively, held just that issues of subject matter jurisdiction that were not raised in a plea cannot be considered, essentially that those are waived. But that violates the fundamental principle that subject matter jurisdiction is not acquired by waiver and can't be waived. And that also is not a mandate of 51014. 51014 actually expands appellate jurisdiction. It in no way restricts review of subject matter jurisdiction. And that is a duty that the court expressly has. It just has a fundamental concept of separation of powers and is recognized in ex-association of business, Lutzenheiser, Gibson, and a host of other cases. The courts.
So your argument is that we should recognize subject matter jurisdiction, sovereign immunity, as complete subject matter jurisdiction issue. If we haven't said it before, you say we should declare that.
Yes, subject matter sovereign immunity can't be waived. If that's your question.
Well, I mean, if it's not purely subject matter jurisdiction, then I guess it could be waived. So your argument has to be that sovereign immunity is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction all the time
for all purposes.
It is.
Because, like, the things that you've brought up that have to do with separation of powers issues and taxpayer issues and the different issues that are associated with sovereign immunity don't apply to all aspects of subject matter jurisdiction, right? And so, I mean, we could say that for certain purposes, sovereign immunity is part of subject matter jurisdiction, but for other purposes, like whether it gives rise to avoid judgment or whether it's waivable, it's not. And so that's our question, or that's my question, is why would we consider it that subject matter jurisdiction for those purposes when it carries so much baggage with it?
Well, I think one reason is that it's judicially efficient to resolve issues when they're on interlocutory appeal. We're talking about jurisdictional issues. I mean, you know, the court, if the court determined that subject matter jurisdiction, sovereign immunity could be waived by failing to raise it on an interlocutory appeal, that would create a host of problems because it would violate the rule that the court has established over and over again, which is that sovereign immunity deprives the trial court, deprives courts of subject matter jurisdiction as a general matter.
I think Justice Brister argued in his concurrence in the Riata case that maybe it's not subject matter jurisdiction for all purposes, the component pieces. You can raise it at any time. It's never waivable. It makes a judgment void. You can collaterally attack the judgment long after it's rendered. And maybe those pieces or characteristics of subject matter jurisdiction should not all belong to sovereign immunity. So the question is being able to raise it for the first time on appeal one of those characteristics, or should sovereign immunity be different from subject matter jurisdiction in that respect?
I don't think so. I mean, I think sovereign immunity, whether a court can consider a claim and whether a entity retains its sovereign immunity shouldn't depend on whether it was raised in an interlocutory appeal, because it goes to the question of whether the state can be sued in its own courts,
but
and
it might
also
be,
deference.
You know, we held in that Jones case that immunity from liability could be waived if you didn't raise it, and although we said immunity from suit is different. Maybe it's not completely different. Maybe if the government wants immunity from suit, it should say so at some point. That's the question.
Well, certainly the government should claim immunity from suit, and it did so here. And if the case were remanded, if the court held that the Court of Appeals correctly remanded this case, then there's nothing to prevent the hospital from raising sovereign immunity again in a plea to the jurisdiction.
There's an argument that the plaintiff might be entitled to discovery on the jurisdictional issue. What's your response to that?
The answer is no. These claims are clearly barred by sovereign immunity. There's no waiver under the Tort Claims Act for murder or assisted suicide. And there was clearly no use by the hospital of the bag, and there was clearly no condition of the bag that caused the harm. These are all well-established standards that the court can apply.
And that a fact question, though, as it pertains to the bag?
No, even assuming that the plaintiff's pleadings are correct, taking their pled facts as true, the jurisdictional defect is incurable here because because as a matter of law, the hospital did not use the bag, and a condition of the bag did not cause the harm, even taking as true their pleadings.
Would they be entitled to some discovery to delve into that specific question, or should the state's word just be taken as true, or would they get some discovery on that?
It's not taking the state's word as true, it's taking the plaintiff's pleadings as true. And even taking their pleadings as true, their pleadings affirmatively negate your jurisdiction in this case. I can imagine a case where there might be a fact issue regarding jurisdiction, or if there's a curable jurisdiction defect, like a failure to correctly plead all the elements. In that case, certainly it would be appropriate for a remand to replead, especially in a case where jurisdiction is raised for the first time on appeal. But that's not this case.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Black will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Basically, we think the question here is whether or not the Court of Appeals has the authority to go outside its limited grant of interlocutory jurisdiction to decide that a trial court lacks jurisdiction. Especially when you consider this facts, that the trial court never had the opportunity to rule on a plea of the jurisdiction, was not brought to their attention, and we did not have the opportunity to do any discovery on a plea of the jurisdiction.
It sometimes happens that even after a full trial goes to, maybe it's a jury trial, goes to verdict, judgment's rendered, goes up on appeal, maybe it goes to the Court of Appeals, comes to this court, and for the first time, somebody thinks, wait a minute, it wasn't ripe, there's no standing, some jurisdictional problem. And the law is pretty clear. The court has an obligation to look at that, even though nobody's looked at it before.
Yes, sir.
Why shouldn't that rule apply here?
That'd be on a final judgment, Your Honor. And what we contend here is that this particular statute, it gives jurisdiction to the trial court except for any specified exceptions made in that rule. And one of the exceptions is the filing of an expert report that we did, and they're challenging it, and they were overruled basically by the trial court. So they could appeal on that issue. But I think the law would say everything else remains within the trial court's jurisdiction. Only that one issue was appealed, and it was interlocutory. Therefore, we think the courts are confined to follow the statute, and if the order was not signed before the trial court denying jurisdiction, it cannot be considered on appeal, just as Lowry said, Your Honor. Now, what we have here, as the court has noted, we're not looking at a situation where you can look on the face of the record and see, for example, that a JP court can't award $1 million in damages. It's not the issue here. There are some discovery issues that have still yet to be determined here, because we've basically been cut off completely from taking depositions. Discovery has been stayed because of the expert reports, and we're not taking one oral deposition in this case. So what they're asking this court to become is actually a fact finder. And that's not the role of the appellate courts, it's the role of the trial court. And they're saying there's nothing we could ever do to show liability. We think there is. We pled liability. And also we think there are some things that could be discovered that we still do not know about. It's in the record before the trial court that, just briefly on the facts here that make a difference on discovery, there's a record that was produced to us by the state that there was a witness, apparently a client or a patient at Rush State Hospital, that witnessed a staff member put a plastic bag over Travis's head. And we think that that's important to depose that witness and find out the circumstances. They redacted the name of the witness and wouldn't even tell us that person's name. And so what you're looking at here, let's say this example could have occurred. If it shows that Travis was in fact murdered, that would be a defense. But if there's some other intent involved or negligence, that would not be a defense. For example, let's say, and we don't know what the facts are because we're not there, Travis died behind closed doors. We hadn't seen any discovery to any extent whatsoever. Let's assume that Travis, due to stress of the hospitalization, was having some type of hyperventilation. And perhaps an employee thought, well, we would like to use a paper bag, but none's available. So we'll use a plastic bag in the interim. And that if that in fact happened, that would be negligence. But what they're trying to do is do an end run on us and cut us off before we had one chance to take a deposition in this case.
Well,
yes, sir.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like if we send this case back, you know, it goes back down, do you agree that they have a right to bring the plea to the jurisdiction in the trial court rather than here? And so we're dealing with the same law issues?
You know, they probably can. I'd like to argue waiver, but that may not work. I think that's an argument I could make on that. But if they go to the plea, the problem with that, Your Honor, is that we're going on an incomplete record without discovery of the facts. That's, I think, the critical issue here, because we hadn't had the discovery that we needed to determine what happened here. And we're kind of going into this thing blindfolded because we just don't know what happened without discovery. And I think it's very essential that we have that information to be able to, and the trial court. Trial courts do this all the time, Judge. Your Honor, they will maybe limit the amount of time for discovery on a jurisdictional issue, and then maybe set the plea of the jurisdiction. That's an orderly process that makes sense in line with the statutory law, Your Honor. We think that's something that could be done. And then the plea could be considered at that point in time, possibly. But that's something that could be done in an orderly
process. Can you answer this issue, though, that we keep coming back to that has to do with subject matter jurisdiction and whether it must be raised in the trial court or it's waived? I mean, that's an issue that we're dealing with at the front end before we get to the issues that you're talking about now.
We think they can waive sovereign immunity.
Okay. And what about the question about whether clearly we've said that for certain purposes, sovereign immunity is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. But if you look at Justice Brister's dissent in Riotta, he talks about how for all purposes, it would not have to be considered subject matter jurisdiction. For example, that it could be waived. And so what is your response to that question?
Well, that it could be waived. There's a good policy reason for it, I think the court talked about. If it can't be waived, let's say you have a judgment that is 10 years old, and for the first time, now they're bringing sovereign immunity at that point in time. There are policy considerations that you shouldn't be reopening judgments that have been around for 10 years or so. So there's good reasons to say that it can be waived, Your Honor.
What's a good reason here?
The reason here? Because they failed to assert it timely.
So any time the state fails to assert it at the trial court level, then it's waived? Is that the rule?
Well, Your Honor, I think in this particular situation, if they went through trial and failed to assert it, I think that'd be a difference. In a locatory situation, I think they probably still can do that at the trial level, because it's not a final judgment yet.
And if your current theories that you've pled do not assert a valid waiver,
right,
the opportunity to replete it after discovery is what you're after?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that we'd have the chance, should have the chance, hopefully, to be able to do the discovery and then see what the facts are. As we know, many times in trial law, we don't know what all the facts are, and we have to start out pleading certain things. As discovery progresses, then we might learn some new theory that would be something we'd have a cause of action on.
They say that your pleadings negate all basis of jurisdiction, so that you've pled yourself out. And how would you respond to that?
We have not pled ourselves out. We've actually pleaded that they have provided property, used property concerning Travis. We also allege that they gave some property that was inherently dangerous. I think it's a critical issue in this particular case, if we go to that. And what I was want to ask the court to consider is going back to the Cowan decision. It begins with this particular statement from Justice Hecht. It says, the issue here is whether merely providing someone with personal property that is not itself inherently unsafe is a use within the meaning of the act. So what happened in the Cowan case, the plaintiff did not allege that the suspenders, I believe it was, and the rod was used to hang himself, they didn't allege it was inherently unsafe. No allegation made about that. Now what we have here, and that's why the court did make the distinction as it began the introductory paragraph, in the limited discovery that we have gotten so far, We believe Rush State Hospital had a policy in effect at the time of the incident that they classified plastic bags as being inherently unsafe in a psychiatric setting. And so we're saying that by their own definition, what they're saying is that that plastic bag is inherently dangerous, inherently unsafe. And there are cases that go along the lines for some time that say you cannot provide defective property to somebody, that that can be an exception to the sovereign immunity and the user condition theory that we have. So I think that's an important distinction there, Your Honor, that inherently dangerous is a very critical thing. You cannot say something is inherently dangerous and non-defective at the same time. Those terms are mutually exclusive and cannot go together. And so if the state says it's inherently dangerous, they have to admit that it was defective. And if they provide a defective property to Travis, then they are liable, and the sovereign immunity is waived in that situation. And I know the court also ruled on Posey. Posey was a situation where, of course, the inmate hung himself with a telephone cord that had some exposed wires. There's some talk about the defect being the exposed wires in that particular case, but nothing about that defect caused the death of the person. And nobody in that case alleged that, nobody found or alleged that that particular cord was inherently dangerous. That's, again, a very important distinction in the case law. We think is very significant. So going back to some of the policy matters here as far as why should the court not consider or let them raise jurisdictional issues for the first time on appeal. What that would in effect do is almost try to change this into a mandamus action. We know that in mandamus, that's a original proceeding, and the court, but the court cannot grant those unless if there's any dispute as to what the facts are. So when you have a dispute of facts like we have here, we believe that makes a lot of difference. We believe that jurisdiction will only pass to the appellate court only to the extent that the specific order allows it to be done. So if there's no order in the trial court denying jurisdiction, that cannot be heard for the first time on appeal. It cannot be piggybacked on because it denies us the right we have to do discovery. And it looks like the legislature had a specific intent here. It looks like their intent was that there's going to be a limited situations where there can be interlocutory appeals because it's going to disrupt the flow of the trial and cause delay. So the state need to follow that in this particular situation. If they're going to appeal on something, they should list it all at one time and not try to add something on when you get to the appellate court level. For example, would they say that you can list all the other 10 items that are set forth in 5104.14, that just because you got up on one issue that you can have an appeal on interlocutory, can you now add class certification, motion for summary judgment as to government employees, can you add all those on just because you had one that got you to the appellate court?
That takes us back to Justice Green's question, though. We send it back and then they can raise it at the trial court level now for the first time, and it's going to come right back to us.
Your Honor.
How do we remedy that if we don't want to take a second look at it?
Right. Well, what I'm saying here, basically, Your Honor, is first we say the pleadings we do demonstrate a waiver cause of the inherent dangerous property we've alleged.
So how would you write this opinion if you were writing it?
What I would say on that particular situation, Your Honor, first, I think the number one issue that has to be reached first is the whether or not they can raise a jurisdictional issue at this point in time and add it on, and I think they cannot. But secondly, if they could do that, we believe that sovereign immunity, we've alleged facts that would destroy sovereign immunity if we can prove those things. If we can prove that this plastic bag was inherently dangerous and defective as we've alleged, and that the state hospital provided that bag to Travis, then there's a waiver of immunity in that case, Your Honor. Also, I would say, Your Honor, with all due respect, that I believe that we'd have an opportunity at some point in time, and if that wasn't enough, to go back and take some depositions and have some amount of discovery on the jurisdictional issue and let the trial court decide what the facts show. Because the problem we have here is that the trial court is the finder of facts. That's the job of the trial court. And that's what has always been recognized in our jurisprudence, that they decide the facts. I know the court gives deference to what the trial court does. So I think that's a critical issue there, Your Honor.
If you win on your second point, we don't have to address the first point, though.
That'd be great, Your Honor. Yes, sir.
Wasn't a statement of intention.
I understand. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. But that's true. That would make everything on that moot. Or I should say, that'd be sufficient. If we could prove that, then I think it would make everything, all that go away, all the jurisdictional issue go away. Yes, sir. But basically, I think I pretty much summarized what I want to tell the court and ask the court to consider in this case. We believe that what is happening here, that if the state can do this, it contravenes the legislative intent of being very specific on what can be appealed in interlocutory judgment. So they're very specific, and the hospital did not follow the law in what they're trying to do to add things on. Didn't follow that, and they're trying to actually usurp the authority of the trial court. You almost have really two courts having jurisdiction at the same time. The trial court really should have jurisdiction to determine its jurisdiction at this point in sovereign immunity, because they're not authorized. The state's not authorized to make that appeal on jurisdiction yet. You almost have two courts with an overlapping with a jurisdiction to some extent over the same issue. So we think the appellate court was not entitled to consider that. But if it does consider that, we believe that the facts in this case very clearly demonstrate, if we can prove it, we say we have, and the law would say that our pleadings have to be taken in consideration that they're true and that give us the benefit of the doubt on the pleadings, because there's been really no meaningful discovery. And the pleadings we have, we feel demonstrate there's a waiver of sovereign immunity because of the inherently dangerous exception. That has to be an exception, we believe, because you cannot have something inherently dangerous and have it be non-effective at the same time. You cannot marry those two concepts in any event whatsoever.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Blake.
Thank you all. Thank you for it.
It pleases the court. Having considered Justice Lerman's question a little bit more in the last 20 minutes, I would say that sovereign immunity should not be considered waived on interlocutory appeal because it wasn't raised below, simply because it certainly is not waived in the trial court. Even the plaintiffs agree that the hospital can raise sovereign immunity as a jurisdictional bar in the trial court in a plea to the jurisdiction. So, looking at the trial court's subject matter jurisdiction, it is clear that it is barred by the hospital's sovereign immunity. The failure to raise sovereign immunity in an interlocutory appeal wouldn't waive its sovereign immunity in the trial court. And because we're looking at the trial court's subject matter jurisdiction, there's no reason to not address that issue here. Addressing plaintiff's allegation that inherent dangerousness is a condition that waives immunity, the answer is provided in Cowan, and the answer is no. The Tort Claims Act waives immunity for a condition that's defective only in its intended or ordinary use. There's no allegation here or dispute that the bag was not used as intended here to cause the harm. There's also no allegation that the hospital used the bag. As the court held in Posey and Cowan and Bosley, the issue is use, the hospital's actual use of the property, not the provision of the property.
What if it's true, as he suggested, could be true? Discovery might show that the hospital did use the bag for hyperventilation treatment or something of that sort.
Well, plaintiff had an obligation to plead that. His allegation is that the hospital merely provided the bag, or the hospital murdered Travis, or assisted in the suicide. And all three of those claims are clearly barred by the hospital's sovereign immunity.
Has this court overruled the Texas Tech
case, the provision of
low
a
case?
Piece. What say, what is
the
it?
Low case?
Yes, where the university didn't use it, it provided equipment that was, you know, in some sense defective. We haven't, I know we've kind of written around that, but I don't think we've overruled that concept. And this would be a case more like that, you know, where the, an item was provided by the hospital that the hospital itself acknowledged was inherently dangerous in that setting, and it caused the harm that one might predict.
Well, Lowe has been limited to situations where the government has provided defective equipment that lacks an integral safety component. There's no allegation that the bag lacked an integral safety component in this case, and therefore Lowe wouldn't apply. There's also other distinguishing features of Lowe from this case, which is in Lowe, the student was required to wear a uniform that was defective. In this case, there's no allegation that the hospital required Travis to put the bag over his head for any reason. And there's also no allegation that the bag was defective in its ordinary use. And that is the test for condition under the Tort Claims Act, as this court has held in Posey and in Cowan. Finally, just to sum up, the Court of Appeals decision violates the fundamental principle that this court recognized in Gibson, that subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time, including for the first time on interlocutory appeal, because without it, the trial court and the Court of Appeals is powerless to act. The court should reverse the Court of Appeals judgment on the jurisdictional issue and dismiss plaintiff's remaining tort claims as barred by the hospital's sovereign immunity.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. The cause is submitted, and that concludes the arguments for this morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.